This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour.
It's great to be with you. I appreciate you joining us today. I'm Joel Hilliker. Today we're going to talk about a couple of developments in modern warfare. In the Middle East, we're seeing an increasing use of drones. There have been some attacks and attempted attacks from Syria against northern Israel, from Yemen against Saudi Arabia. Israel has launched drones against Hezbollah and a Palestinian faction in Lebanon. This is a low-cost, low-risk military investment, but it's capable of potentially devastating results. We're going to hear a report on this development from Trumpet writer Anthony Chibatadwe. Then we'll talk about a secret space program Germany has been conducting for the past decade that has just been revealed. Germany has a long history of military surprises, and we need to look at what it's doing here in that context. Trumpet writer Josue Michels is going to tell us about that. In our third segment, we'll look at some fascinating research that's been done on the Bible, specifically on some stunning features in its use of language, features that point to the Bible's divine origin. We'll hear a report from Chris Eames, who writes for our sister website, Watch Jerusalem, about this subject. Do stick around for that. And I'll conclude the program with a few words about how to make sure you're accomplishing the important things in life. We'll begin by hearing about this new form of warfare growing in the Middle East, the use of drones, in this report from Anthony Chibatadwe.
For several months, the Israeli army has been surveilling an Iranian terrorist cell in the Golan Heights, Israeli territory situated in its northern border with Syria. The operatives comprising this cell were organized and trained by Qasem Soleimani, the ruthless commander of Iran's Quds Force. The Quds Force flew into Damascus International Airport with a plane they'd loaded with drones, explosives, Shiite militiamen, and other Iranian advisors, and then headed out to set up base in a village in the Golan Heights and advance their plans to attack Israeli cities. On Tuesday, August 20th, the terrorist cell heard news about airstrikes against a compound for Iranian-backed Shiites near Balad Air Base in Iraq. They realized that they had to move fast. Just 2 days later, on Thursday, August 22nd, they set out to launch their drones strapped with explosives. The Israelis had been keeping a vigilant eye on them and even recording them on camera as they prepared to launch an attack that would kill many Israeli civilians, something that has been called a large-scale attack of killer drones. In some fashion, perhaps electronically, Israel thwarted that attack, but somehow the terrorists retained possession of their drones and explosives. Finally, Israel conducted airstrikes against the base on Saturday, August 24th. The following day, Sunday, Israel did something it rarely does. It publicly acknowledged that it had indeed conducted the attack. The spokesman for the Israeli Defense Forces told reporters that this is an incident that must be made public. He said Israel is prepared defensively and offensively, acknowledging that there could be more developments. He said that these drones are the same that we see in action in Iraq, Syria, and Yemen. These are drones Iran has tried, tested, and perfected over and over again, and now with greater frequency than ever before. Perhaps not very long after the comments from the IDF spokesman, Iranian-sponsored Houthi rebels in Yemen launched drones targeting Aba Airport in Saudi Arabia. In response to all of these attacks and threats, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said, "Iran has no immunity anywhere. Our forces operate in every sector against Iranian aggression. I have directed that our forces be prepared for any scenario. We will continue to take determined and responsible action against Iran and its proxies for the security of Israel. And that precisely is what Israel has been doing. Still on Sunday, by this time in Lebanon, Israel launched its own drones in a stronghold of Iranian terrorist proxy, Hezbollah, south of Beirut. And later, Israel attacked a compound for the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine, another Iranian terrorist proxy in eastern Lebanon. According to Hezbollah's leaders, these were Israel's first such hostile acts since the 2006 Lebanon War. Lebanon's Hezbollah-aligned president went as far as saying that the attacks resembled, quote, a declaration of war that entitles us to resort to our right to defend our sovereignty, independence, and territorial integrity, end quote. In a statement on Sunday, Hezbollah's leader, Hassan Nasrallah, said that Prime Minister Netanyahu would be mistaken if he thinks that this issue can go unnoticed. He said that the time when Israeli aircraft come in and bombard parts of Lebanon is over. His statement continued, quote, from tonight, I tell the Israeli army on the border, wait for our response, which may take place at any time on the border and beyond the border. Do not live, do not rest, do not be reassured, and do not bet for a single moment that Hezbollah will allow aggression of this kind. Later in the day, a suspected Israeli drone strike in Iraq killed two members of an Iraqi militia aligned with Iran. Middle East analyst Seth Franzman wrote in the Jerusalem Post on Sunday, quote, the drones, airstrikes, and tensions stretching from Yemen to Iraq and then to Syria and Beirut comprise an arc of simmering conflict that links Iran's role throughout the region. The report that Iran wanted to use Kassif-type drones, the kind the Houthis have used against Saudi Arabia, against Israel from Syria, shows how these conflicts are increasingly linked. In addition, the presence of Shiite militias in southern Syria, whether linked directly to Hezbollah or Iran's Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, or to Iraqi-based militias or to local Shiites in Syria, shows how the patchwork of Iranian-linked paramilitaries are entrenched in a corridor of influence stretching from Beirut to Baghdad. This has been called Iran's land bridge, and it came into full view over the weekend. End quote. Iran has both the determination and the capability to terrorize United States allies in the Middle East, especially Israel. Its new drone strategy is potentially devastating. Iran has also used drones via its proxies to attack oil shipments in the region, a problem that has global ramifications. As successful as Israel's counter-strategies might be now, it's clearly not enough to confront Iran one proxy at a time or one drone base at a time. In the end, says Bible prophecy, a superpower will soon emerge out of Europe that will confront Iran and its proxies in an all-out war. Europe is prophesied to, quote, come out against them like a whirlwind, with chariots and with horsemen and with many ships, and it shall enter into the countries and shall overflow and pass over. That's from Daniel 11, verse 40. But in the meantime, Iran's seemingly unremitting attacks on Israel will lead to the fulfillment of other prophecies. Zechariah 14, verse 1 through 5, show that Jerusalem is about to be violently split in half. This prophecy is much closer to fulfillment, especially when you consider some of the weapons of choice for Iran and when you consider the current pace of events. In Jerusalem in prophecy, Trumpet editor-in-chief Gerald Flurry writes, quote, "Looking at the ongoing violence in Jerusalem today, the absolute inability of the involved parties to solve things by peaceful means, we can easily see how one half of Jerusalem shall be taken captive in the very near future. The present violence is an embryo that is about to grow into much greater violence. That is the critical event prophesied in Zechariah 14 verse 2. We will see this prophecy in Zechariah 14 fulfilled very soon, and while it will involve some sickening atrocities and bloodshed, it is directly connected to the greatest news this world has ever heard." That news that Mr. Flurry was talking about is the good news of Christ's return to establish the kingdom of God on earth. Verses 3 to 11 announce that news in advance, concluding with this assurance: "There shall be no more utter destruction, but Jerusalem shall be safely inhabited."
Thank you very much for that, Anthony. Very interesting seeing all of this develop. I wonder if you could just talk about some of the reasons why drone warfare would be attractive to Iran and why we're seeing this spike in drone attacks lately.
Well, for one, drones are fairly cheap. Mm-hmm. I mean, even drones that anyone can buy online, they can be strapped with explosives and sent out to cause a lot of damage. And the damage is a lot more substantial if the drones are even more sophisticated. So that's one thing that really attracts them to nations like Iran. And another thing too is that they are very agile and they are small enough to evade radar sometimes. So that makes them very appealing for Iran. In fact, Israel has been prioritizing targeting these drone bases before these drones are released, before they are airborne, mm-hmm. because it does get a lot more complicated to try to stop them after they've been released. So that's why Israel has been trying to target these drone bases. And if Israel does intercept them, or if Israel does attack them before they are launched, then a lot of devastation is prevented. But if Iran just continues flooding its drones and weapons to its various terrorist proxies spread across the Middle East, in Yemen, in Syria, in Iraq, it's not going to be easy to try to go after each and every one of those bases, each and one of those drone bases before they are launched. So it really is getting a lot more challenging for Israel. There have been many reports of how much Israel has just stepped up these attacks, these preemptive attacks. I think there was a report that said that in the 5 years leading up to August 2017, Israel had made 100 airstrikes in Syria alone, just in 5 years up to 2017. But that number has grown to more than 1,000 airstrikes. Mm. Just up to January 2019. So you're seeing that Israel is just a lot more vulnerable, and it's going to be hard for it to keep up with it, especially if Iran realizes that this is a fairly cheap and somewhat efficient way of attacking its enemy.
Yeah, it's not too difficult to see why Iran would be attracted to this kind of technology, considering how the type of warfare that it tends to use is what we call asymmetrical warfare, where it's It's trying to get the biggest bang for your buck. You know, obviously an attack like 9/11 shows how much damage can be done with a well thought out plan that costs really nothing other than, you know, some plane tickets, some box cutters, that type of thing. And you could see how drones would definitely fit into that. It's interesting that Israel is showing that it's not averse to using the technology as well. And I guess I'm just curious how good, you mentioned that the drones are able to evade radar, how good the defenses are that Israel would have in preventing this, and whether the balance of advantage would play more into Iran's favor or Israel's favor as this form of warfare becomes more common. Do you have any thoughts about that?
Not very specific thoughts, but Israel does certainly have a lot more advanced technology. However, it's not invincible. In fact, one of its, actually two of its drones were reportedly downed in Lebanon. Some reports said that Hezbollah actually hacked into the drone and brought it down, at least one of them, and then says that the second drone, Israel probably exploded it just so that it doesn't get into enemy hands. So despite its technological superiority, I think that it does have its shortcomings. And then when you consider this, for example, just the conflict in Lebanon, we know Iran is the main player, but if Israel does get into a more complicated conflict in Lebanon, it will primarily be with the Lebanese, and Iran can continue conducting its malicious activity elsewhere. So Israel would be attacking Iran in a somewhat indirect way. And it might even get bogged down in a conflict like that. So whatever Israel might do to try to limit the harm, it still has a lot of vulnerabilities.
Mm-hmm. Well, we do appreciate you bringing that report to us. We've been talking to trumpet writer Anthony Chivadere about the rise in drone warfare in the Middle East. He's working on an article about this for thetrumpet.com. You can watch for that there on the front page. Thank you very much, Anthony.
Good to be here.
This is the voice of the Trumpet News Magazine. You're listening to Trumpet Hour.
For the past 10 years, Germany has been leading a small, secretive space program. It's been so secretive that many in the German armed forces have been unaware of it. So what is Germany up to, and how concerned should we be about this? To talk about this, we have trumpet writer Josue Michels. Hello, Josue.
Good morning, Mr. Hilliker.
So tell us about what Germany's up to here.
Yeah, the Artillery vote recently was meant to show that Germany is heavily involved in space, but it just doesn't like to talk about it that much. Other nations like to boast a lot about their abilities in space, but Germany much rather likes to keep it a bit more secretive. The German newspaper Die Welt said that the Bundeswehr activities in space are hardly known even to many in the armed forces. So those very forces that rely on the space program don't even know much about it. How much less do foreign nations or armies know about it? So the simple reason why Germany doesn't talk much about this program is to avoid drawing too much attention to it.
Yeah, how did we find out about it?
Well, just recently was announced that they ordered some new spying capability satellites, and that had drawn a little bit attention to it. But the main purpose is that the government doesn't talk much about it. So the news are out there, but the German government just doesn't draw much attention to it. For example, France likes to announce its next development in space, or the United States does that, or Russia boasts about it, but the German government just usually doesn't talk much about it. That's why we usually don't know much about it.
So I definitely want to talk about why Germany would be so secretive about a program like this. And it is interesting when you put it in contrast with how many other nations are very forthright about their capabilities and even boastful about those capabilities. But let's just talk about why space is such an important frontier for warfare. What are the strategic purposes that Germany or really any nation would be seeking through building its capability in space?
Yes, since the Cold War, space definitely has become more and more important. All major nations are pretty much involved, and other nations rely on the involvement of other nations, of the major nations, for the military, for GPS, for analysis of the weather, or for observing the space, or just surveillance of the Earth. So even the military became very heavily dependent on it, and all of us are really dependent on it. Anytime we use GPS, we rely on the space programs of some nation.
So the fact that nations are becoming more and more dependent on these technologies, it does pose some vulnerabilities. You could definitely see how nations would be interested in beefing up their capabilities in that arena, but also that it would open them up to some vulnerabilities. We've talked quite a bit about the disadvantages to, say, America being as dependent as it is on space technology. Maybe you could just talk about some of the disadvantages and some of the problems posed by this type of warfare.
Yes, that's right. Many nations have become very dependent on their space programs. It's just as simple as a person that relies on his or her iPhone or phone or navigator to go any place. Once you lose signal, that person is pretty much lost wherever it is in that moment. And if you think about it at a large scale, a whole military can be lost. It can't coordinate its strikes. It also doesn't know where the enemy might strike from and where it might strike. So defense becomes much more difficult for any nation if it loses its signal with space. And recently, there were quite a few developments that sparked those fears even more. India, I believe, struck down a satellite, one of their own satellites, with a rocket, and they just showed, well, if they can strike down their satellite, they can also strike down our satellites. And France also announced that they will equip their satellites with laser weapons, which can also destroy other satellites. They say it's just for defense purposes, but of course it can also be used to destroy foreign satellites as they wish.
So the potential for space warfare to have a massive impact in some kind of a global conflict is higher and higher the more dependent we become on this. And you could see why Germany would really want to beef up its capabilities in this respect. But let's just talk about what would motivate the German government to be secretive about this. This is actually something that it's kind of par for the course with Germany. There have been other times where it has been very secretive about its military activities. Maybe you could just talk about that aspect of it.
Yes, and just if you think about what Germany does, it makes sense that they want to be secretive about it, because Germany's capabilities in space are mostly about spying about on other nations, on foreign territories, probably also on other satellites. So you don't want other nations to know that you are spying on them, so you are much more keen to be secretive about those capabilities. And we have seen that repeatedly in history, that Germany does keep its military advances secret. And even in recent history, we have seen that For example, Germany has recently worked on laser weapon technologies, and most people haven't heard about that because Germany doesn't make big announcements about it. It also has worked for years and on hypersonic weapons, and even there the German media didn't know much about it till just this year where it was announced. But they have made already tests before, they have the technology, and now they said, yes, we have been working on this and we are soon to have a breakthrough here too. And then also, just recently they announced that they will keep their military report secret. Now, people are not much scared about that because Germany's military hasn't been at its peak in recent years. But maybe that's just why they want to keep it secret now, because they're about to build it up. They certainly have the technology, they have world-class weaponry, they just haven't been arming their army with it.
Yeah, Churchill famously said that Germany was a country fertile in military surprises. And you've actually written articles on all of these points that you just brought up. I'll just draw attention to the one that you wrote, I guess it was earlier this month, called German Laser and Hypersonic Weapons Soon to Be Reality. And then a couple, some time ago, you wrote Germany Classifies Its Military Status Report as Secret. Both of those articles are available on the front page of the Trumpet. So I definitely want to talk about why this is important prophetically, but really, if you just look at Germany historically, say the way that Churchill did, why should we be concerned about Germany undertaking these kinds of activities in a clandestine way?
Yes, so most people probably know about Germany's warfare of Blitzkrieg warfare. So that heavily relies on its ability to surprise other nations. So France was surprised and was overrun in 6 weeks. If France would have known about Germany's military upgrades and military build-up, they might have not been as surprised than they were.
Yeah, I'd like to just interject for a moment. You have this quote in your article about Germany classifying its military status reports from Gerald Fleury in his Winston Churchill, The Watchman booklet. And it says, he understood Germany's history of surprise attacks. The air staff fully agreed with him. Germany had been fond of such attacks, and this is the method of warfare they followed throughout World War II. This happened repeatedly to Hitler's enemy nations and even those who thought they were his friends. So this is definitely something that we've seen a pattern throughout German history.
Yes, that's right. And it's not the same pattern in other nations. Like Russia, for example, it likes to boast about its military advances because it doesn't want other nations to meddle with their affairs. They like to take on weaker nations and take them on one by the other, and they want to deter other nations from stopping them, so they boast about their military. Germany, on the other hand, much rather likes to surprise other nations and take them head on and with a blitzkrieg warfare.
So let's talk about the prophecy. What does the Bible inform us about what we can expect from Germany in the years ahead?
Yes, the Bible actually is very specific that this history would repeat itself. And the prophet Nahum talks a lot about Germany's strategy of deceit. It basically says, don't trust Germany's lies. They say one thing, but they do another. The book of Daniel talks about the surprise attacks Germany will lead. So all over Bible prophecy, we see that Germany has a strategy that will repeat itself. And often that's what makes our job here at the Trumpet so hard. People write off those warnings of a militarizing Germany because they don't see it in their news. No news media are talking about it. But that's exactly what Germany wants. They don't want anyone to talk about their military. They don't want anyone to talk about their advances in space because they know their strategy and their main advantage is if they can keep it as secret as possible till they strike.
Very interesting. And you may notice that our correspondent here, Mr. Michels, has a little bit of an accent. He is a native German, and so he's reading so much of the news. Like you mentioned, this report from Die Welt earlier in our conversation, he's reading a lot of this information in German native news sources, and so as little as the German press is talking about it, it's definitely talking about it more than what we're tending to read in English language press. So we definitely appreciate the asset that we have on our staff to be able to examine those things and keep up with what's going on in Germany. We really appreciate your time, Josue. We've been talking to trumpet writer Josue Michels about these secretive endeavors that Germany is undertaking, particularly this space program that's been going on for about a decade now that we're only learning some details about very recently. He's written an article about this. The title of that is The German Army's Unnoticed Space Program. You can check that out at thetrumpet.com. We'll also put links to a couple of other articles that he's written in the show notes for today's program, one about Germany's laser and hypersonic weapons, and another about Germany classifying its military status report as secret. You can find all that at the Trumpet Hour Hub at thetrumpet.com. Josue, thanks so much for sharing all of that with us.
I'm glad I could join you.
This is Trumpet Hour with Joel Hilliker.
The Bible is the most widely published, closely scrutinized, and studied text in all of history. And researchers are discovering some stunning features in its use of language, features that point to its divine origin, as we will hear in this report from Chris Eames.
There are a number of different ways we can look at proving the veracity of the Bible. There's history, archaeology, and regarding the proof of the divine inspiration of the Bible, the best concrete evidence for that is prophecy. Fulfilled prophecy. And that's something often discussed on the Trumpet Radio. But there's another area that also proves the divine inspiration of the scriptures, and that is the language of the Bible. Research shows that the scriptures are literally filled with remarkable linguistic nuances and unexplainable coincidences. Professor Chaim Shor from Israel's Ben-Gurion University, he's a scientist and a self-described non-observant Jew, he examined the language of the Bible, researching the science behind many of these coincidences, so-called. Here are just a few of his fascinating discoveries that we'll go through that relate very seriously to the question of divine inspiration of the Bible. So we'll start off with some of the basic stuff and then get into some more complex details. So letters in the Hebrew alphabet, like Roman numerals, they have a numeric value. A word's numeric value is the sum total of its letter values. So you add up the values for each of the letters, and that'll give you the value for the word. For example, the total sum of the Hebrew word for pregnancy, hereion, is 271. The number is significant because it happens to be the median number of days for a pregnancy. On average, pregnancies last between 266 and 280 days. So here we have the word pregnancy fitting right into the median number there. At 271. And Shor suggests that there's a unique and intended significance in the early Hebrew word for pregnancy, equaling the number of days for a pregnancy. And there's a human hand. The word is yad in Hebrew, and it adds up to 14. There are 14 finger bones in the human hand. Here's another example. The Hebrew word for year is shana. In the Hebrew calendar, a complete non-leap year is 355 days. What's the value for the word shana? You guessed it, 355. In biblical times, and this is getting a little bit more complex now, in biblical times, days were still customarily divided into 24-hour blocks. So midday and midnight occurred at the sixth hour, as it was known. Sixth hour of the day and of the night. Any significance behind these words, midday and midnight? Midday, Tzaharaim, equals 345. Day, Yom in Hebrew, equals 56. The value for midday divided by the value for day equals 6, or rounds to 6. Midnight, on the other end of the scale, midnight, Neshef, equals 430. Night, Lil, totals 70. So the value for midnight divided by the value for night, again, 6. So these are two completely separate sets of numbers, and they both equate to a rounded figure of 6. Now compare the day and the night. In Jerusalem, the average daylight duration is slightly longer than the night, so we have about 51.8% for the day versus 49.2% for the night. The value for the words morning and day in Hebrew add together to get 358. The value for the words evening and night equal 347. Now, to the nearest tenth of a percentage, the Hebrew words for morning and day represent the exact numerical percentage of time of average daylight. And likewise, with the evening and night, the dark is the corresponding numerical percentage. Now, Professor Shore also found that the value of the words for colors, like red, adom, and yellow, tzahov, they match up with their wave frequencies. Now, how could the ancients have known all of these coincidences? Typically, evolutionary scientists paint them as blundering simpletons, just grunting out primitive words. And they especially like to downplay the complexity of Israel's past compared to that of the other nations around them. But where did this ancient mathematical linguistic precision come from? Even granting, if we grant ancient Israelite society a high level of complexity and intellect, how humanly possible is it to have this level of intricacy, this level of complexity underlying the common language? And remember, these are ancient biblical words, not some modern mathematical Hebrew synthesis that's been put together by scholars. These are words that have been discovered on artifacts going back some 3,000 years ago. Here's another example. The word ozen is another interesting Hebrew word. It's the word for ear. Now, the Hebrew word for balance is ezun, which comes from the same root word, ozen and ezun. Now, today, we understand that our sense of balance comes from a mechanism in the air. But that was only discovered at the end of the 19th century. So was it just coincidence that the biblical Hebrew words for ear and balance are directly connected? How could they have known? There are other interesting nuances in the Hebrew language of the Bible. Hebrew words can often be read forwards and backwards with different meanings, and those meanings obviously get lost in the English translation of the Bible. But here's an example. Genesis 6 verse 8 says, Noah found grace in the eyes of the Eternal. Now, grace is actually the same word as Noah, inverted. So again, just coincidence? Are all of these things that make up this beautiful text, are all of these things just coincidental? Or could they be a special, divinely added depth and richness to the language of the Bible?
Thank you very much for that, Chris. It's a fascinating subject. I think some of the individual examples that you used are interesting. It does seem to me like that you would probably get an argument from the skeptic saying, well, okay, that sounds kind of coincidental. But the thing is, the more you look into this subject, the more evidence you find. Maybe you could just talk a bit about the broad subject of Bible numerology and how much preponderance of evidence there is that there's more going on here than just coincidence.
Sure. Good to be here. And I will mention as well that these examples from Professor Shaw, they are a small tidbit of a huge book he's produced on it, 330-page book on the subject. So there are many more examples. That book can be found online. But beyond this, his studies relate to the field of biblical numerology, biblical numerics. And this was largely discovered and researched by a man named Ivan Panin. So he lived from 1855 to 1942, and he was a real pioneer in the subject of Bible numerics. And so, without going into too much detail here, basically, Bible numerics looks at the way the verses of the Bible are laid out, and it looks for any underlying rhythms, numeric rhythms in the Bible, the use of important numbers, and if that makes up the way the Bible was written, if there's some kind of mathematics to the way the Bible was written. And so what Ivan Panin discovered, for example, I'll use Genesis 1 verse 1, first verse of the Bible, as an example of this, with regard to the use of the number 7. Now, a lot of people who have studied the Bible, they'll be familiar with the number 7 being a particularly significant biblical word, significant divine number. It's the biblical number of completion. And so there's quite a few times that the number 7 features in this verse, Genesis 1 verse 1, in the beginning, God created the heaven and the earth. So in this verse, there are 7 Hebrew words. The number of letters in this verse is a multiple of 7. There are 28 Hebrew letters in this verse, so 7 times 4. The verse is broken up into 2 main sections, which are a multiple of 7, 2 main parts, 14 letters each. The nouns in this verse add up to a multiple of 7. The single verb in this verse adds up to a multiple of 7. The 3 leading nouns in this verse, God, heaven, and earth, equal 777. The value of the first and last letters of all the words add up to a multiple of 7. And so this kind of goes on and on. There are actual, we've listed 8 different, I think that was 8 different uses of the number 7 in this verse. There are actually 31 different combinations from this verse, 31 different times that the number 7 features in this verse. And that's insane,
right?
That you can have that level of numerics behind such a small singular verse. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth.
And from what I understand, there have been scientists and literary scholars who have tried to write something that plays by the same rules, or that has the same kind of internal consistency as far as the numbers go, and they're just not able to do it.
Right. I believe it was a team at Harvard that tried to do this, tried to recreate some kind of language where you could have this level of numeric perfection, and they just weren't able to do it. So how is this coincidental? And we've just looked at the first verse of the Bible. Obviously, the number of completion, 7, would be particularly significant for this verse. But it isn't only this verse. And without going into all the additional details, this pattern continues through the Bible. Another significant passage is John 1 verse 1, which follows the same general makeup. So this isn't just in the Hebrew Bible. This is in the New Testament as well. So it helps show the divine inspiration behind not just the Old Testament, but also the New Testament as well.
So this is very compelling research. Why is it not known more generally? Why don't we hear more about this? Why aren't there scientific journals that are jumping all over this information?
Well, like I mentioned with this Professor Shaw, Chaim Shaw, he's a self-described non-observant Jew, not a religious man as such, and he took his research before some different scholarly outlets. He sort of summarized it to them in the hopes that it would be published. And I've got a quote here from him. He explains why these publications didn't take it further. He says, the reader may wonder why the statistical analyses in this book have not been submitted for publication in recognized and highly esteemed journals like Science or Nature. The answer may be easily guessed. No journal was willing to even consider reviewing, let alone publish, papers with claims as displayed in this book. Open-mindedness to all facts of nature, a source of pride for many highly revered journals, ended when claims of a religious flavor, no matter how scientifically corroborated, were involved. So that really gets at the heart and core of it. If it's got a whiff of religion to it, we don't want it, essentially, is what these scientific journals are saying, which is pretty troubling.
Yeah,
to have our educators in society, the people teaching our children, teaching the next generation, that they don't want any of it, no matter how scientifically corroborated it is. They have their theories of how the world came into being and their theories about science and evolution, and we don't want anything counter to that, essentially.
Very quickly, Chris, what would you point people to if they want to learn more about this?
Well, an article on the subject will be going up on Watch Jerusalem, the sister website to thetrumpet.com, watchjerusalem.co.il. It should be going up in the next week, I would think. And then there's another article that we've got on Watch Jerusalem, and I believe on the Trumpet as well. What's the title? I think it's the Bible Scoops the Scientists. So this article looks at a related field. It looks at all the science that has been written about in the Bible, but that man has only just rediscovered, shall we say, in the last few centuries. Incredible scientific knowledge that actually was always under our noses in the Bible. So you can find that as well on Watch Jerusalem and thetrumpet.com. The Bible Scoops the Scientists.
Okay, thanks so much, Chris. We've been talking to trumpet writer Chris Eames about remarkable linguistic features of the Bible. Chris has written an article. It went up yesterday on our sister website, watchjerusalem.co.il. Go check that out. We appreciate your time, Chris.
Thank you. Been a pleasure.
It's time for today's last word.
What if somehow you learned that you would die in a week? If you were given just 7 days to think back over your life, what would be your assessment? How satisfied would you be with what you accomplished? What would you regret having left undone? Are you really spending your life on something that makes a difference? Are the truly important matters getting enough of your attention? What draws you away from those things? What could you trim or push aside or cut out? Moses was contemplating these kind of questions when he wrote Psalm 90. He wrote, "We spend our years as a tale that is told. The days of our years are 70 years, and if by reason of strength they be 80 years, yet is their strength labor and sorrow. For it is soon cut off, and we fly away." And then he drew this conclusion, and it's really beseeching God. He said, "So teach us to number our days, that we may apply our hearts unto wisdom." When you recognize just how brief life is, you gain sharp clarity of thinking. Just look at yourself. Honestly evaluate. How are you using your days, your hours, and your minutes? Are you just marking time, or are you truly numbering your days so you can apply your heart to wisdom? Are you devoting energy and effort to the significant things? Are you prodding yourself, aiming high in order to truly use your life and fulfill your God-given potential? A successful life demands being purposeful and driven. Your time is your most valuable asset, and you don't even know how much or little you have. All you know for sure is that supply is limited. The devil knows your time is limited. He built modern society specifically to consume your attention with trivialities, to swallow your time, to draw you away from what matters. If you just do what comes naturally, what comes easiest, you're going to be swept up in a torrent of distraction that takes you far away from anywhere you want to be. Don't get trapped in trivial, quickly forgotten busyness. You have to establish your priorities and then trudge toward them step by step against resistance, daily, hourly. Regularly evaluate what you're doing and make sure that you're heading in the right direction. Don't let your priorities fade and disappear and then replace them with new priorities that you also let fade and disappear. Once you establish your priorities, sprint, lumber, clamber, scrap, fight, and crawl toward them until you have achieved them. Look at your daily tasks and ask yourself tough questions about each one. Is this really important? How will this further a long-term goal? How much impact will this have that will last beyond this week or this month? What's going to have the most long-term significance? Does this really fit with and advance my real purpose in life? Is it just diffusing my energy and preventing me from accomplishing what I need to? If so, can I delegate it or can I cut it out completely? Always aim to devote as much time as possible to work of lasting value. Focus on what's really important. Focus is what's going to determine your success in achieving those important things more than anything else. If you can't focus on something, you won't accomplish it. If you can, you will. For fruit trees to reach their maximum yield, they have to be regularly pruned. And Jesus Christ said, growth in your life also requires continually pruning what isn't producing. Every branch in me that does not bear fruit, the Father takes away, and every branch that bears fruit, he prunes so that it may bear more fruit, he said in John 15. Unwanted, unhelpful growth, that's natural. Extra obligations, diversions, projects, preoccupations, these bud and blossom all the time. And that's why pruning is so critical and why it has to be continual. At any moment, stop and ask yourself, what am I doing right now? Is this really what I need to be doing? And evaluate it by the fruit. Is what you're doing producing good results, meaningful results? Are they building your family? Are they helping others? Are they advancing God's work and God's cause? You can't afford to waste time. You've got to prune anything that is stealing your minutes and not contributing to what you produce. In order to focus on the important things, the less you think about other things, the better. So set limits on what you consume and do. Eliminate the unessential. Cross off what's not really important. Postpone things that don't really need to be done right away. Keep your focus locked in on what's really important and prune everything else. This is a continual process. You have to prune, then prune again, and then again. You got to do it monthly, weekly, even daily. This is how to maximize your time and energy. If you're doing something important, you're moving in the right direction, even if it's happening slowly. As Earl Nightingale said, never give up on a dream just because of the time it will take to accomplish it. The time will pass anyway. I'm Joel Hilliker, and that'll do it for today's Trumpet Hour. Feel free to send me any thoughts that you have on the program today to letters@thetrumpet.com. I appreciate my guests coming on, Anthony Chabadirwe, Josue Michels, and Chris Eames. Thanks to Jesse Hester for engineering and production. And I'll leave you with this thought from John Dos Passos. In times of change and danger, when there is a quicksand of fear under men's reasoning, a sense of continuity with generations gone before can stretch like a lifeline across the scary present and get us past that idiot delusion of the exceptional now that blocks good thinking. Thank you for joining us on Trumpet Hour. Until next time, keep watching your world.
You've been listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.